All right, we are back. A couple months back, we took a trip down to Berkeley in the Bay Area to have a chat with Michael Perini. Dr. Perini is a political scientist who got his degree, his PhD, from Yale in 1962. He's taught at a number of colleges and universities. He spoke with us about the media. We aired that originally on March 6th and aired it again last week. While we had Dr. Perini in front of the microphone, we also chatted a bit about his most recent book called The Assassination of Julius Caesar, A People's History of Ancient Rome. Dr. Perini, what got you interested in writing a book about the assassination of Julius Caesar?
What struck me was how the history of that period, the late Republic and Caesar and the other reformers, the history was distorted very much the way present-day stories are often distorted. That here you had a man who is judged through history and by those who assassinated him as being a usurper and a tyrant. That he was killed because these senators were worried about the Republic and did not want to see the Republic hurt in any way. That's the usual view, and that he was usurping their Republican rights. The truth is they hated him because he was indulging in redistributive politics. He was, in fact, supporting rent control, land redistribution, debt cancellation, job programs, grain dole, food dole for the very poorest. And these were seen as things that were totally intolerable. These infringed upon the wealth of the wealthy class. So it was the wealthy class that killed Caesar because he was actually given a little something to the people. And that so struck me as being so reminiscent of what we see today, that when any popular leader gets up and tries to give something to the people, he is immediately subjected to ad hominem attacks of all sorts. The Sandinistas in Nicaragua, Hugo Chavez in Venezuela today, and others, they are immediately demonized and they're attacked, always under the name of preserving democracy and the rights of people. But these senators weren't really interested in democratic rights. They immediately handed their power over to an emperor when he gave them a better deal and made sure that their wealth was secure and accumulated.
Now, I guess for some time in Rome, there'd been a division into sort of party politics somewhat reminiscent of today, the optimates and the populares.
That's correct, yeah. The optimates were the rich aristocratic families, numbering probably not more than 20 or 30, who monopolized most of the top offices and who monopolized the wealth and who were making sure that the public lands were taken over by them for their own private profit. You had these immense public lands all around Campania, which were farmed by independent farmers working as cooperatives, paying a modest rent to the Roman government and feeding all of Rome. So here you had people working, earning money, feeding the entire population, and the very rich were not making a penny in profit. This was intolerable. These public lands had to be privatized. And that process of privatization of natural resources and lands is going on right to this day, that still continues, to make sure that the public sector does not feed, create jobs, create income, create goods and services that people use and live without private interests earning something. So the issues were very much evocative of what we see. Also, the history in itself was just a very interesting time. Rome was a fascinating place. Rome's social structure was fascinating. The book has a lot of sex and violence in it.
Tell us a bit about how this guy got in the position where he was, you know, possibly going to become leader of all Rome. He was, I guess, a wealthy playboy, or he was an opportunist. He's been described many ways. How did he get in that position?
Well, he wasn't an opportunist. When he was very young, a pro-senatorial dictator took over named Sulla. And Sulla murdered some 5,000 or 6,000 people who had been supporting reforms and such. And one of the people he targeted was young Julius Caesar, who came from the populares strain. Caesar's uncle by marriage was Marius. Caesar's father-in-law was Cinna, who was Marius's associate, also a populares. Now, Sulla came along. They were both dead by now. Sulla was reigning supreme. If Caesar was just an ambitious fellow, he would have switched sides and joined Sulla. He would have been welcomed in, and he would have been elevated up there.
There'd been, in essence, a civil war in Rome that Sulla had prevailed in.
Well, it hadn't been an out-and-out civil war. His army got in there after Marius died and killed a lot of people. There was a coup, and there was a takeover. And Sulla brought a Roman army into Rome against the wishes of the people, because there was a sacred rule there that no Roman army can come into the city of Rome itself. A very interesting thing. And the people stood the whole army off for some hours, apparently throwing missiles, rocks, anything they get their hands on, with such a vehemence that the legions stopped and wavered, and it took a bit of doing. But once Sulla took over, he went and purged and killed and murdered and executed, and Caesar instead fled, and he came back after Sulla died some years later, about 4 or 5 years later, and re-entered politics again. He was a popularis; he was for the people, and very popular among the people. But subjected to an awful lot of... Every time he tried to make reforms, he found there were threats and there were dangers. So he ended up becoming a military leader. And the next time he came back around, he had an army at his back. And then there came a civil war with him and Pompey.
He basically decided that conquest of Gaul might further his ambitions. Is that correct?
Yes, which it did. First of all, it gave him a tremendous source of war booty and paid all his debts and all that. His goal was to rule with Pompey in conjunction. Pompey, though, had become very jealous of his prestige, his growing fame by now. And so Pompey switched sides and became an optimate, became a tool of the optimates. Caesar repeatedly said, "Let's you and I disband our armies, come in and we'll join peacefully." And Pompey would have none of it. The optimates wanted really to finish him off. So that's when Caesar did what we all call crossing the Rubicon. He literally crossed this river called the Rubicon, which today the phrase means an irreconcilable decision of momentous import. And he did it and marched down, and there was a civil war, and Caesar emerged triumphant from it.
We're speaking with political scientist Dr. Michael Parenti about his book, The Assassination of Julius Caesar, A People's History of Ancient Rome. I've always been struck by the fact that Caesar is listed among one of the great historians of antiquity, and that when you're describing the conquest of Gaul in favorable terms, it helps if you're the guy writing the history.
That's right. He did write a history of Gaul, which I think portrayed him in most favorable light. He didn't soft pedal some of the rather rough and terrible things the Romans did in Gaul. He's not a hero of heroes. He did some things that were very undesirable, too. For instance, be an imperialist and go conquer other countries. Whenever you wage war, and that's a lesson for today, whenever you wage war, you generally are, generally, not always necessarily, but you are generally committing far more evils than any virtues you can profess, especially when the other country is weaker and isn't really bothering you and is not at your gate and is not threatening you in any way.
Well, he winds up in a war with Pompey in the east, I guess, and sooner or later Cleopatra enters the picture. This seems to be a great gold mine for Hollywood over the years. What can you tell us about what happened out in the eastern part of the empire?
He and Cleopatra hit it off very well. She was a woman of lively turn and enticing ways, it has been said. You know, I wanted to say something actually about the Roman people. One of the themes I deal with in the book is the people throughout history of Rome have been treated like a mob. They're the people in the arena who scream for blood. They're the people who just sit there looking for free entertainment and free bread rations, you know, bread and circuses. The final chapter is called Bread and Circuses. And the truth of the matter is that the Roman people fought very valiantly for better housing, jobs, land redistribution. They backed the populares leaders. Those leaders couldn't have been gotten anywhere if they weren't standing on the shoulders of these people. They organized into what were called collegia, or what we call guilds or unions in many cases. They tried to fight off the goon squads and death squads of the optimates. And the Roman people were not a mindless mob at all. I just want to make that clear. In fact, the ruling class, proportionally, there are probably more members of the ruling class sitting in the arenas watching the bloodletting than of the poor. So that's another issue. And yet, it's very interesting how the historians throughout the ages have taken this elitist view, that how they see the world through the eyes of the Roman Senate. And when you offer a different perspective, they say, well, you're committing the sin of presentism. You're imposing your values on those times. And I say, well, you are uncritically accepting the values of the ruling class of that time. If we should immerse ourselves into the experience of Rome, why not into the experience of the Roman plebs, the ordinary proletariat of Rome, who had all sorts of other views to which you are rather indifferent, just as they are indifferent often to the sufferings of ordinary people today.
Well, what happened to Caesar? He'd been successful as a military general. He defeated his rival. He had the Queen of Egypt on his arm. He's back in Rome. He's setting out to reform.
Well, a lot of reforms which he had already initiated were really getting through. And he also forgave a lot of his former enemies. A lot of the senators who sided with Pompey, he forgave them, let them keep their Senate seats, and even gave them appointments of some note. He sought to box in the Senate. He thought that proscriptions, which is what Sulla used, proscribing, which was meant a way of putting you on a hit list that you could be subjected to execution, he thought that only led to further hard feelings and more strife and more. So he was going to co-opt them, get them to work with him so they wouldn't be off in the shadows plotting against him. Well, He underestimated the fact that a ruling class can never forgive any leader for infringing on their privileges. There's only one thing that the ruling classes throughout history have ever wanted, only one thing, and that's everything. They want everything. They want all the best lands and herds and all the rich mineral deposits. They want all the goods and services. They want all the trade. They want all the privileges, all the sinecures. They want all the civilities of and comforts and services of civic society, and none of the cost, none of the taxes. This is what they want. And the minute you expect them to make a change or let go of one little thing, they get furious and they see you as a leveler, as a revolutionary, as someone who's destroying society, destroying the republic, and the like. And so Caesar, at the height of his power, was assassinated by these fellows. I have a whole chapter describing the assassination itself.
The book is called The Assassination of Julius Caesar, A People's History of Ancient Rome, and we are speaking with author Michael Parenti about this work. How did the conspiracy come together to take him out? Do we know? Does history know?
The best we know is that it was one senator named Cassius who approached his relative, Marcus Brutus, and the two of them began the plot. And they got about 60 senators, or maybe 40, I forget. It's a rather surprisingly large number in on the thing. We know about 15 of them by name. Cicero was not one of them. They decided not to bring Cicero in on it because he was generally a coward and a fidgety guy and all that, and they just decided push him aside, but he was delighted by the results. But he was very unhappy about what came after the assassination, which is that they decided to keep Caesar's reforms because popular feelings were so high. And he said, we've gotten rid of Caesar, but the thing that made us hate him, which was his reforms, I thought that was a very revealing quote, those are still here. So it wasn't that Caesar was a usurper or trying to make himself king, it was that he was this reformer. I also, in the book, talk about earlier popularis, the famous Gracchi, the Gracchi brothers, Tiberius Gracchus and Gaius Gracchus, they were both assassinated in 133 and 121, respectively. And then you can go on down. Clodius was assassinated and a number of others also. Whenever they tried to do any kind of land redistribution or tried to build up the proletariat in any way to fight back and get some or expand democratic rights, these senators opposed them. The senators opposed the posting of the Senate debates, the discourses, public publishing of the debates that went on, which Caesar was one of his reforms. They opposed the secret ballot. Cicero, I have a great quote from Cicero. He says, you have a secret ballot, then we can't see what mischief the common rabble is up to, you know. And you look at Cicero and you hear what he says about the people. He calls them the scum, the urban feces, the rabble, the back, you know, the backwash. total loathing. And that view of the common people, you can see it through all history, many historians. The view of the common people in the French Revolution is the same way. And yet the studies we have, who was this mob in Rome? Who was this rabble in Rome? I'll tell you who they were. They were carpenters, they were tavern keepers, cobblers, teamsters. They were the working proletariat of Rome. That's who they were. They were day jobbers. They were people. They were ex-farmers driven off the land who had to come into Rome, try to find work. They were the ordinary working people of Rome. My book, The Assassination of Julius Caesar, A People's History of Ancient Rome, is just that. It really shows you that it's the people, ultimately, who give you the better part of history, and they're the ones we have to look to.
Even these many centuries later, Julius Caesar is still a household name. And yet it's been argued that his nephew, Octavian, had a much greater influence on the course of the Roman Empire and by right should be more famous, but he's not. Why is that?
Well, Octavian, who later became known as Augustus, he took Caesar's mantle. He was Caesar's nephew, and he took his mantle and he played on that name and won support for it. But he just accrued power to himself and did nothing in the way of reform. The only two taxes he instituted was a death duty and a sales tax, both of which were very regressive. He left the wealthy class's wealth untouched. He started to bypass the assemblies, where Caesar used to go to the assemblies rather than to the Senate. He took power away from the assemblies. He took power away from the Senate. But he kept the Senate there, and they were there administratively serving him. Now they did do just what Caesar had wanted them to do for the Republic, they did for the Empire. They served him. They never found too much fault with him because he left their wealth perfectly intact. In fact, made many of them even richer than ever. So he was a very popular fellow with that ruling class.
Did any of his great uncle's reforms, did they survive very long?
No, the only reform that really survived was his reform of the calendar, the Julian calendar, which later got touched up again by Pope Gregory. So we know it as the Gregorian calendar. But it really, 90% of all the work in that calendar was really Caesar, who was an astronomer of some note. He was polymathic, and he worked with the leading mathematicians of the day. The grain dole was kept, but land redistribution was pretty much undone. And the land was in the hands of the aristocracy. The final lesson is that we have to place our faith not in the Cassius and Brutuses, and not in Marius, and not in Sulla, and not even in Julius Caesar or the Gracchi. We have to place our faith in the people who fought hard for economic justice. In fact, we are the people.
The book is The Assassination of Julius Caesar, A People's History of Ancient Rome by Michael Perenni. It will be in bookstores in June. It sounds like it's a heck of a good read. We recommend it highly. If you'd like to know more about his work, you can go to his website, which is www.michaelperenti.org. I should mention that Dr. Perenni has authored 250 articles that have appeared in Covert Action Quarterly, Z Magazine, New Political Science, Monthly Review, The Humanist, Dollars and Cents, The Nation, and numerous other publications. He appears on radio and television talk shows to discuss current issues and ideas from his published works. Dr. Perenni's talks and commentaries are played on radio stations and cable community access stations to enthusiastic audiences in the U.S., Canada, and abroad. You are listening to Radio Parallax here on KDVS 90.3 FM. I'm Douglas Everett. Stay tuned for the third segment where we're going to talk about a bunch of stuff. We're going to talk about some science issues today.